narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host of the Alabama Lost Souls podcast. I'm joined by Adam Camilleri.
Hey.
And Red Powell.
Hello.
Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here as well.
On this episode, we have, I'm going to insert some segments with artists and painters that are contributing to the Nova Open Charitable Foundation. If you listened to us last week, you know that we're going to be running some live stream, getting some enthusiasm for their final hours of their raffle ticket sales for some absolutely stunning models. And I thought it'd be great to bring some folks on to this episode to talk about it. Later on in this episode, I've got a segment with Brent Amberger from Goobertown Hobbies. I've got a segment with Oscar Lars, a buddy of mine. Painter has been in White Dwarf. He's got his own YouTube channel with tutorials and stuff, and Duncan Rhodes, and maybe some more. You're gonna
just
hear
a few,
all that.
Just a couple of small timers. You know, you've probably never heard of him. You know, I mean, who is Duncan Rhodes really?
We're gonna get to the bottom of it in a fully supercharged expose. No, we don't talk about that. We talk about all stuff leading up to the Nova Open Charitable Foundation raffles. And they're fun segments, and I hope you enjoy them. I'll put them all together in the middle of this show. So it'll be us talking. We'll take a break. You'll hear me talking to some painters. And then we'll come back and finish talking about whatever it is we're talking about.
Yeah, whatever it is to talk about. I've got my prediction for the previews on this weekend. I reckon I know what the Space Marine stuff is.
You think so? You got it?
I think I got it. I think I do. I'm gonna see what Red has to say about the Necron stuff. But the Space Marine stuff, I reckon it's that little old land speeder we saw a while ago that we haven't heard or seen a peep from quite some time. And I'm assuming we're going to be getting a release date for the quad bike as well with the new codex. I'm assuming that's going to just an assumption that both those units, as well as the new Predator, what was it called?
The Gladiator.
Gladiator, yeah.
Gladiator. I'm assuming the Gladiator is going to be included is going to be a data slate in the new codex as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if those are the trifold announcements we're going to get. You know, Space Marines, they just need more models, man. That's just not enough.
I like that Gladiator more than I think I want to admit. Like, I'm a fan of the Impulsor, and I guess the Repulsors. The Repulsors, they've never really quite done it for me.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. It looks like something an orc would make. It's just got a few too many guns in it.
To me, it looks kind of like a near sci-fi thing.
Yeah, that's true. Like maybe it's overly practical.
Yeah.
Less extravagance.
I mean, I know it doesn't look like a real tank. I'm not trying to offend you. It's a fantasy tank, but it looks like near sci-fi. Now, this is not bad. I'm just saying that it just kind of like, I could kind of like, you know, I'm going to use it if the rules are cool kind of thing.
Yeah, that's fair.
But the Gladiator, I really dig it. I guess it's the extra guns. Maybe it needed two more guns than the Executioner.
Well, I thought the Repulsor was a bit too big to be a single shape model. And I know it's weird for me to say that, seeing as that's exactly what the Land Raider is. And I love the Land Raider. But I don't know. Maybe it's because it doesn't have tracks. I feel like it's just like a shoebox with as many guns as they felt like throwing on it. And what always confused me as well was how many of the same profile gun there were on it. Like, it had the Onslaught Gatling Cannon, then it had the Baby Onslaught Gatling Cannon, then it had the Twin Heavy Bolter as well. And you're like, well, these are all the same gun, essentially. Different ranges, but the same strength 5-1. Now, some of those might be changing as well with the new decks, because it's been alluded to that they might be getting different strengths and different ranges adjustments. So I think there's a bit that's going to be going down in this codex, but hopefully it's interesting without being punitive to everybody else, which is what the last one was.
Well, I do imagine that over the course of the next codex releases, we will see range adjustments on things. I mean, simply because of the geography of the game or whatever. Or maybe we won't. I don't know. I think that we probably will, though, because when I look at armies, one of the ways that I assess them is their threat bands. You know, how do they radius out, and what's their board control? What is it really? What's the actual effective threat range or bully range or whatever of a unit?
Well, that's perfectly said. And well, it probably segues into the Necron side of things if you wanted to, because Necrons have been notoriously someone that's struggled with those different threat ranges, those different bands of efficiency, whereas they only really had either a flyer or it was a Doomsday Arc. There's the only thing that could hit the back of the board when you were playing Hammer and Anvil. But now with the difference in points, like the 36 inches you get on a Destroyer's Gorse, whatever the cannon it is a heavy Gorse
So the destroyers have two weapons. I mean, and both of them are far reaching. Even the heavy Gauss beforehand, the heavy destroyer was still, it was still a las cannon, right? 48 inches.
Yeah. But whereas the others were 36, and now 36 is all you need, especially on a platform that moves, what, they move 8 inches or 10 inches and fly?
So the old ones were 10 inches, and they were actually only 24 inches range. The old Gauss the regular destroyers was 24, but still, I mean, in current day and age, 32 inches is just about right. Right. It's not
especially when
bad.
you can deep strike as well, or jump around with the Veil of Darkness.
Mm-hmm. Veil of Darkness, yeah. And the new terrain piece that's inevitably coming out. But I gotta jump back. You guys can't get away from talking about tanks and not let me go on it. I let you guys keep going just to see where it was, but then you jumped sharks on me and started hitting on Necrons, and I'll come back to that. Don't worry. But when it comes to tanks, man. Okay, so last time, Paul, you were talking about the documentaries and the oil painting and everything.
Yep.
Well, Netflix has a documentary as well. I mean, it's kind of like a show series, and it is all about tanks. And I am trying to pull up the, but I
do they cover the executioner?
It's called The Age of Tanks, right? And literally the first episode, you feel like you're just watching a bunch of Land Raiders, because that's the old, like the initial, like World War One British model, the mother, right? And so that's where Land Raiders, that's where like Le Mans, that's where all the tanks and everything. Essentially, most of the designs of Warhammer that you look at, it doesn't matter almost any faction. Probably the only ones that get it right, as crazy as this sounds to a certain extent, are Bane Blades, like Bane Blade chassis. Yeah. And so when you look at the barrel versus the platform and everything, right? And then also when you look at Tau tanks, right? So it's about building, like, what is a tank for and what does it do? And you go back to this Age of Tank show, which I'm totally plugging because I just get excited about tanks. And, so what was the tank built for? What is it supposed to do? What is it, what is it really meant to do? And so that's where, when you talk about, the repulsor executioner and some of the aesthetics to it, it's really weird that it's this big, high profile. And by profile, I mean height, right? It's so tall. It's tall, and it's just got that, what I would argue is kind of that the turret isn't, when you look at a shadow sword and you see, I understand that the cannon to the shadow sword is fixed, right? It's not like that turret turns or anything, but still, like, that is the kind of cannon that I'm talking about, that like when you want long range precision fires, that's going to reach out and really touch something that's not going to get back up after you touch it. Like the shadow sword is like the nailed on tank of the modern age, right? That's a main battle tank.
And are you talking about like a good barrel to chassis ratio that looks like it could keep it in place, it won't just flip over when it fires?
Oh yeah. We're not talking about the early age. So I'm not saying that this actually, but so there were personnel carriers and things like that where they tested it. The barrel was too much for the chassis itself, right? So like there is a balance to it. But at the same time, I mean, okay, so I have a tank, take the repulsor, that has grav, it has grav plates to it, whatever. It's stabilized. It's extremely stabilized. I mean, if I've got a tank right now in the year 2020 that I can balance a beer can off the barrel while it moves, I bet you those Space Marine tanks are going to be off the chain. Right. Like, yeah. I bet you I could line up a 12 pack on top of that executioner barrel and they wouldn't move. Like, that's how stabilized they're going to be. And so given that,
they wouldn't be shook up when you cracked one.
That's right. Right. Yeah. They're going to be smooth. Right. And so like when it comes down to it, like, I want a barrel that says this thing's going to kill you. Right. Like, this is not something that it even has to get into the fight. Like, so, I mean, I'm sitting here looking at my table over here and I can see the Basilisk barrels, standing out far, far and beyond. Why wouldn't you build that kind of weapon into the chassis, right? Like, that's kind of the point. And so when it comes down to it, we talk about the Gladiator. I think the Gladiator has a little bit more, and to your point, Paul, it has a little bit more of that barrel to chassis ratio kind of deal. And again, it does go back to what is it for, right? The repulsor arguably is also, the repulsor is almost kind of in like an Israeli Merkava kind of category because it carries troops, right? And so when you look at like the Rhino,
I love it. Like he said, what he just said, like, we know what that is.
Oh, man, come on now.
I love it.
The Israeli main battle tank. It carries people in it as well as destroys things.
I got the context. I just really admired the confidence in us that you had when you just said it.
Drop a line like that. You guys know what I'm talking about.
Just Google it. Merkava. You'll love it. It's awesome. It's an amazing tank. You got to watch this show. Go ahead.
So is there a type of tank that we don't have represented in 40K? Because I know we've got the kind of the first gen ones represented in things like the Malkadors. The Malkadors kind of represent those first gen wonky tanks. I never quite knew where to put the guns or how many they needed. And then there were the other ones, which were essentially like the Land Raiders, where they were kind of more of a breaching vehicle. Well, that's what it feels like to me. They were more for breaching lines and covering terrain rather than actually doing significant damage themselves. Is there a gen of tank we don't have represented in 40K? Like, is there a stylistic version?
I would argue no at this point. I mean, really, because so like if you take the Abrams or the Leopards or, you know, some of the high tier main battle tanks, you know, the Shadow Swords, the Bane Blades, like they kind of represent those main battle tanks that really bring a lot today. Even so, like Rhinos, I mean, if you look at the it's called the M113 or even the newer model that's being developed that you can see in the news today. I mean, those look exactly like Rhinos. And then when you take something like an infantry fighting vehicle, whether you know the Russian BMPs or whatnot, that's kind of what Chimeras are modeled after. The Imperial Guard tanks are, you know, their regular battle tanks are very much in line with it's almost kind of like older Russian models as well as British models. That turret on top, like, it always makes me laugh, like the stubby little turret, that's the battle cannon. And you know, there's all kinds of, I mean, don't get me wrong, like it is what it is. Like, I totally acknowledge they've got a, I mean, as a good friend reminds me, the technology in Warhammer 40K, they don't necessarily understand everything they're dealing with, right? Like,
yeah,
to an extent, like, you take it to the tech priest to get him to work on it, and he's over there like rubbing butter on it, like praying
to work. Please work.
Right. So, like, you know, that's a whole other thing. But so I mean, I'd say there's pretty good representation by and large. I mean, again, like the that kind of killing power, and knights kind of take that kind of step into it as well. You know, they're not tanks, but what they accomplish kind of gets to it. I mean, it's, you know, even with, and I know I'm stretching out a little bit, but just looking at these vehicles, but even like the Manticore and MLRS systems, you know, rocket systems, right? Missiles, long range missile systems and whatnot. Like, it's all represented to one extent or another. It's just a matter of range. Like, there is some degrees of abstractions of range that you have to accept. I think I've talked about it before. There's that picture out there of like a quote unquote real world version of like a Land Raider next to an Abrams next to like a Carnifex. And so it's just kind of cool to see some of the aspects of it. But yeah, you guys start talking about tanks, and don't get me wrong, I'm super excited to see this Gladiator with all its guns and everything. I mean, so like what you were saying, Adam, that the tank was originally designed to get across what's called the beaten zone, right? To get through kill zones. And exactly right, that a Land Raider is the perfect idea of that. You know, so what we look at is the sponsons, right? Like, whether it's the Land Raider Crusader or Redeemer or whatnot, those tanks were originally built with those sponsons so that they could shoot down into the turret, into the trenches as they crossed them, right? And so, I mean, now it's a little more advanced, and that's when you start looking at turrets and whatnot, and main guns and things like that. The trick is, and I'll stop after this, but just some food for thought in regards to tanks, is that if you find yourself where you've brought tanks to fight tanks, you've actually gone about it the wrong way.
You've made some mistakes.
Tanks are not supposed to fight tanks. That's not the equation. Tanks solve other.
It's a massive waste of resources, and you're going to lose a hell of a lot more tanks than you need to in any other engagement. Yeah.
Does it help that a tank can kill other tanks? Sure, but that's not really what they're there for. And so that's just something, you know, tactics wise. Again, food for thought. But okay,
we know they're for killing titans. That's the Godhammer pattern. An epic. You'd show up with your 50 Land Raiders and you kill people's titans.
There you go.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but Landra as a Lehman Ross Demolisher kills anything, so
man,
I'll take that. Now that we're on to the real, like, actual real life stuff, I've got two questions for you, Red. U.S. Army is pretty much on the forefront of military, you know, ingenuity. How far are we away from a super tank? And why haven't we got one yet? I mean, I'm already disappointed. that you're not like a super tank, a Baneblade pilot in real life, but you know.
Man, so you should look up some, again, watch this Age of Tanks, right? I can't say that enough, yeah. But when it comes down to it, like define, just real quick, since you asked the question, define super tank for me. Idea of a super tank.
Yeah, so what was the rail gun that the Germans made that they barely ever used because it was too fancy? The yeah. gigantic one. So that thing, but on tracks, it doesn't need to be on rails, essentially.
I'll start with sure. tracks.
But less artillery, more mobile gun platform tank-wise.
Yes. So what if I told, right now, as far as it's considered in regards of direct firing systems, I think that if you actually saw it go down, I think you'd be surprised at what the current state of things can accomplish. I mean,
I'm trying to get us on a watch list, Red.
Right, I know, and I'm not saying anything outside that you probably couldn't YouTube. But I tell you what, like, so I mean, so this is the scale that, you know, when you talk about, so a sabo round, right? You know what a sabo round is?
No.
Okay, but so human. Sabos. Yeah, no. So back, like, I mean, we're talking like olden. I mean, as in the 1800s, they got the idea that if they could create with a dart, right? Essentially, a dart, a big large wooden dart, for example, that could be launched at such speeds that it would, I mean, you could, it would pierce through whatever, right? Okay. And so the idea being is that if you look up a sabot round for a tank, right? I mean, it's like a spearhead, and the whole idea of it being that just the pure physics of it, that this spear is launched out of the main gun and it hits at such velocity with such physical force that it will just pierce and destroy whatever, right? And so when it goes through a tank, for example, you know, kind of like what you're probably thinking in certain regards of like a gauze cannon or something, it, you know, and that the whole thing of the gauze or the rail rifle is that it's being accelerated by magnets or whatnot, right?
Yeah.
But yep. When you look at these rounds and the charges behind them, right? So the round itself, I mean, the sabot round, the spear is, you know, longer than your hand, just barely. And then you put it in a round that's longer than, or as long as your arm, right? So that's how much munitions is behind it. So yeah. You put this in and it gets fired off and it hits a target 3 kilometers away and it goes clean through it. And when it pierces it, the physics of it goes through the armor. It will literally, like a physical force, because of how quickly and how hard it hits it, just churn and blender everything inside and pull it through the other. And so, I mean, that's how it works. That's the physics of it. It goes through the armor, comes out the other side, pulls everything with it, and causes that much pressure and force just causes its own explosion.
That's intense.
Yes.
Also, how cool was Red explaining that, by the way?
I had no idea.
So I knew about the concept of rail guns and the concept of like magnetized weaponry and things like that and propulsion. But yeah, I didn't know anything about this sabo munitions. Yeah, that's crazy, dude.
Yes. So that, I mean, and so that's particularly that's vehicle oriented, right? And so, I mean, a tank has multiple rounds, typically multiple types and whatnot that it's going to use to depending on what targets. And so you're not just, I'm not only oriented to fighting one thing. You know, if you went into Warhammer 40K terms, I'd have multiple weapon profiles to a main battle tank, right? I'd be able to say, okay, I'm going to have a blast weapon, right? An HE round, high explosive for, you know, infantry or APCs, you know, lighter targets kind of deal. That's probably like a strength 7 weapon with blast, you know, and then I have a sabot round, which is going to be like a strength 9 AP minus 4, you know, just like the repulsor executioner, which I kind of like the, you know, 3 plus D3 damage. Like it's definitely going to defer at this kind of deal. And so that's, you know, it's fun looking at some of the sci-fi stuff and some of the real world. I mean, cause there's, man, the physics and everything behind the real world stuff is pretty pretty eye-opening when you start looking at some of that stuff. And so when it comes down to it, like how far away are we from the main tank? Or the super tank. I mean, I think that we've seen variations or steps towards what might be the super tank, and really this hurts to a point as the armor officer to say that it's not like we've passed the age of the tank, but I do think that we saw some glory days with it between World War II and Desert Storm and whatnot. And I mean, and there's still main battle, like it's still a major concern, right? Main battle tanks are a thing because they just get around so quickly, right? Like when you look at it in Warhammer 40K, I mean, you take the Executioner or, you know, this new Gladiator or whatever, I imagine its movement's probably going to be like 10 or 12 inches. Even take the Vindicators, right? I mean, now I really love Vindicators. I was running Vindicators with my Chaos Army, and their ability now to move 12 inches and then shoot something 24 inches with strength 10, you know, AP minus 4, D6 damage. Like, I mean, that's pretty exciting. And that's when you take it into real world application, and when you're talking about, you know, four tanks spread across 3 to 4 or 5 kilometers even, and then having a frontage where they're engaging targets 3 to 4 kilometers out, and their ability to reach out and touch something within, you know, multiples of seconds. I mean, that kind of maneuver conflict, when you talk about the void of the battlefield, like it's a very much real thing.
Wow.
And to know that, I mean, there's definitely platforms that get it out there, right? Like that's what it's, what's kind of cool about the Eradicators, for example, and I'm just, you know, talking about paper, rock, scissors here, is that strategic reserves and Eradicators walking off the field and then being able to engage something 24 inches out, for example, that's a totally realistic thing. Like tanks rolling down a central corridor or down the, you know, through a valley, and then there's some dismounted team hidden in the crags or the valley or whatever that are able to reach out and touch with an anti-tank, you know, missile or something. That's a real world tactic. And that's exactly what Eradicators represent. I don't think they deserve as much hate for being OP as they are, when in reality, it's just very realistic.
As intended. Well, yeah. When I think about that kind of stuff, I come back to that scene in Saving Private Ryan, where they get the bombs in old socks with grease on them.
The sticky bombs.
And the sticky bombs. How cool is that scene? I mean, it's a horrific, friggin' horrific scene. The destruction that happens and the trauma and everything. But just as like the ingenuity of
it's a hero moment in the movie.
It is.
Let's say that.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. Well, and so that goes into, I mean, that's the kind of thing, right? Is that, and this has been demonstrated through realistic, and I think that it plays out well in 40K to certain regards too, is that it's not meant, and we've talked about this again before in regards of combined arms, right? Tanks alone are not going to win the day. You have to have some kind of combined concept in order to make a comprehensive approach. And when it comes to like what you're talking about, the ingenuity of infantry to overcome a tank, like they're going to figure out a way to deal with it. If a tank doesn't have infantry support, if it doesn't have the support in one way or another that it needs, it's going to have a blind spot. It's going to have an issue. There's a lot of things a tank can manage or deal with, but it's dealing with things that it's meant to deal with in certain conditions. And so the infantry, just taking like the sticky bomb, you know, concept, are going to find a way to get around it wherever they can. They have to, because they can't just walk up to it.
Maybe that's why the Repulsor Executioner was such an issue, because it was -2 to charge. If you did tap it, it did just fall back and shoot. It had fly, terrain didn't matter, and it had a prevalence of both anti-infantry and anti-armor guns. Like, it sounds like it covered all the bases a little bit too well for people. Well, in respect to all the different layers you could chuck on it in addition to those things. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that you could make a hit on twos re-rolling when you're Iron Hands and operate on full profile and all these other things.
Yeah, no, well, and that's, again, I go back to it, that like targeting, even modern day targeting systems and whatnot of today, like I'd argue, you know, 2+ shouldn't be too far out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah.
In fact, I'd argue professional, in a lot of regards, professional militaries don't practice with main battle tanks for necessarily accuracy as much as they do timing. Right. We're not worried about hitting. I mean, we zero and practice at hitting targets 2 kilometers out. And we're talking, we're hitting within a 4-inch circle. And so like, that's the kind of accuracy. And even when you hit, you know, just 2 inches off of the center within that 4-inch circle, we're still sitting there just dialing it in. And that's just, again, like our practice shot zeroing. And so like, when you go into it and you start looking at some of like, it's all about time and exposure. And that's something that, you remember how old Tau, like 5th edition, like they used to with jetpacks, like they'd move out, shoot, and then move back. Like that's what professional armies with tanks, a lot of time, that's what they're training more so than they are necessarily accuracy, because weapon control systems, firing systems, fire control systems are all managing a lot of the accuracy that goes into it, a lot of it is actually the military, the professional drilling that goes into, okay, I have acquired a target, I expose myself, I engage, and then I cover myself. And that, so like they move up, they shoot, they move back down kind of deal. And yeah. So like that's kind of more in the reality of the speed of combat, I guess.
I mean, even in, so I don't want to derail too much, but I've even got some of the little diaries and stories that I used to read when I was obsessed with like the Napoleonic Wars. Some of the precision the artillery crews used to be able to perform when asked, like, was pretty spectacular even back then.
A very strong case for better BS on guard.
I think there is. I mean, I understand, you know, space marines are the superhumans and whatnot. And I get it. You know, if you set the scale, okay, let's say today's standards of accuracy, you know, okay, that's a 4+ or whatever. Well, then you got me. But, you know, in the same vein, I do think that the executioner and what it does a great job of representing what I think a lot of in conventional conflict today, people kind of feel when they're facing some of these higher tiered main battle tanks.
It translates over to the Gladiator, because I just want to use it because it looks so cool.
I think it is going to be cool. It does look cool. Do you think it's going to be able to hold troops?
I think it'll be in that Predator slot. Right?
Well, they did say it was a Predator. Like, they did say it was literally like, this is the next gen Predator. So I wouldn't expect it to. And I think it might be too much if it does. Like, I feel like the Impulse is nicely placed as the Rhino, we've got the Repulsor as the... Actually, yeah, what is the Repulsor Executioner? Because the Repulsor is a Land Raider. It's the Land Raider.
Repulsor Executioner just has a bigger gun, but it also carries people just like the Repulsor.
Yeah, but it kind of doesn't fit in. There is no non-primary or first-gen comparison for it. There's no other thing of its ilk. Unless it is kind of a Baneblade or a Macarius variant.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. I bet we'll see in the preview. Now, look, I mean, this is not we're doing super. We're going to release this before because we're talking about the Foundation and wanting to drive. Hopefully, come check us out. I'm going to say that several times during the course of this episode, but come check us out during our live stream that's happening directly after the preview. So if you're already on Twitch, just come over to us and the link will be in the show notes and we'll be there talking probably about the preview stuff and all the cool stuff that you might want to pick up in the raffles. But I'm willing to bet we'll see a revamp of some of the chapter tactics. I'm willing to bet we'll see the speeder the fuzzy images of the speeder that we've seen. Mm. And then hopefully a little bit more information about this beast of a tank.
Nice.
I'm hoping anyway. I have a amusing story to share where Forge World, a couple days ago, put up for pre-order Legion Dice.
Yep.
Horus Heresy Legion Dice.
Oh, yeah, they totally did. And I definitely got a healthy amount of dice out of that.
Yeah, so I mentioned to my wife, I said, look, good news is I only spent $1.50 per die. I'm joking around. This is not something, she's going to get on to me about. But she said, okay, how many dice did you get? I said, relax. I only got 40 Stormbolters worth of dice. She's like, what are you talking about? I said, look, 53 Heavy Bolters worth of dice.
That's so good.
I got enough dice to take out, by the math, with BS4, 60 Gaunts. She knows. That I'm pulling her leg here. It is an accurate amount of dice that I purchased, but I know that she doesn't know what this is. So I eventually told her over dinner how many dice I actually got. Yeah, it's a lot.
Did you get 120 dice?
I got a bunch of dice. I don't know if I should. Yeah, it's a lot of dice.
What legion did you get at least?
Blood Angels and Death Guard.
Death Guard. Cool. I was just like, how many Blood Angels did you get? And did you get anything else?
Yeah. So yeah, I've got a couple sets of the original Death Guard dice because they put out some of the legions for a while, but I think there ended up being either some problem with the production or either who they were using to do them or whatever, and so they just didn't continue with the line. So this is the revamp of that line, and the dice are different. The dice they've got this kind of marbleized look now, whereas before they were all, or at least
they're opaque,
single color.
Yeah,
I like these a lot, and I do like the Blood Angels. Happening of the Death Guard are a little bit different, which is fine. But I'm at the age now where like back when I was going using the blocks of dice, they come 36 in a block. I had to have all 36 at the end of the game. I just had to. So at some point I would be like, if I couldn't find them all, I'd get a little neurotic.
Yes. Yeah, I'm the same.
So now I want enough that I can throw in a bag. And you know what? If one of them happens to get lost, it's not going to hurt my feelings.
I have both of those systems. I have my, so you know the store opening special edition black dice that G-Dub did?
Yep.
So I got 40 of those. I'm not allowed to use, I'm not allowed to lose any of those. But then I have my MISC bag that I take to tournaments and I can lose all of those. It's weird. Why am I so precious about dice? I don't know. But it is a thing. It's a thing for us gamers, isn't it?
It is. It absolutely is. Anyway, I got a fair amount of those, but these are not limited run. I think it was mentioned on Twitter that these are going to be like mainline. Like if you decide to play World Eaters 6 months from now, you should still be able to get some theme dice.
Yeah, because I'm super excited about that.
Which ones did you get, Red? Did you get?
I definitely got Iron Warriors, which are going with my Iron Warrior Primaris. And then I got Alpha Legion for my brother. He's got a pretty healthy collection of Alpha Legion. And then I also got the Night Lords.
Nice.
Night Lords I've always been a big, especially from the ADB novels of Soul Hunter and everything. It's really hard for me to not play into Night Lords eventually. And that was... Yeah, you know, so I hadn't seen that, Paul, about them being available over the long term.
I might be wrong. I mean, things are only as available as long as they're available, right? So, I mean, I just think, and what I've heard is that they'll be a long term thing.
And I'm excited to hear that. I don't want that to be untrue. I'm going to totally play into that. I felt the need to what's crazy is I saw those dice, the Night Lord dice available. I think it was at LVO. They were selling, you know, the new Night Lord, like Praetor had just come out and they were selling some of those dice. And I thought that I was going to pick some up at LVO and I walked away from the table and I came back later and of course they were all gone. And so I was like, man, I'm not going to miss my chance now just in case.
They did a really limited run of them last time, and what happened was it was really unfortunate, but they got bought up really, really quickly and then scalped for exorbitant amounts on eBay. I don't know if you guys are up to date with that, but it was kind of a bit tragic. So hopefully that means that G-Dub knows there's a market for continued sales for not like single release stuff or single lines, because they'd be taking the wind out of all those resellers' sails by just saying, hey, they're going to be available anytime you want them. They're right here. Because that did leave a lot of bad taste in people's mouths because they sold out. Some legions sold out instantly. Some hung around a bit longer. But then you'd find what was, I think for us over here, it was $46 for 10 or 20, whatever they sold them as.
And
then
you'd find them. Packs.
Yeah. And then you'd find them for 120, like a markup, 300% markup.
Crazy.
On eBay. And it was just like, you absolutely.
I do understand the need to want to have theme dice. You know, it just feels cool. You know, when you roll up you've got your theme. Oh man, let me tell you, I use my Death Guard dice. I've got two sets of Death Guard. I have a bit of a thing for dice. I think we probably all do. We've now confessed, we've gotten this out that we have a thing for dice. But yeah, I enjoy rolling them, you know, with playing the army or playing kill team or whatever. And right now, I'm looking at the site right now, they're still available for pre-order. So, you know, I can't imagine they're going anywhere, but I'm really excited to get them in my hands.
Yeah.
And they come with just the most adorable scatter die.
I love that they come with a scatter die. Well, I play 30K and I have this little crappy scatter die that I got in the cubes, the old cubes. I'm like, I don't want to use this. Scatter dice. It's a bit sad. But not now I get a sweet one.
There you go. Gonna get it. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and do those segments with the painters, and then we'll come back and talk with us. See you in a minute.
See ya.
See you in a few minutes. There's gonna be several segments. So hang in there. Strap in, guys.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment of Forged Narrative. My name is Paul. I've got Brent Amberger here.
Hey, Brent Amberger here from Goobertown Hobbies. Happy to be here.
Yo, thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
Man, so it's great to talk with you. We're going to be talking with you again on the live stream coming up for the Nova Open Charitable Foundation. But, you know, I wanted to have you on. I mean, you, outside of all of this, like your channel, if people aren't familiar with it, should definitely go check it out. But you just got such a pleasant and infectious way of talking about the hobby stuff and what we do. And yeah, it's really cool. So I'm really happy to get to speak with you.
Well, thanks for saying that. I mean, yeah, if you're not having fun, why are you doing this?
that's it, man. I guess we could just probably stop the segment now. You just hit it right there.
All done. Thanks everybody for listening. It's been a pleasure to do this again sometime.
So we're talking though specifically because you've painted something near and dear to my heart for a good cause. And well, I mean, Blood Angels. I mean, I probably mentioned Blood Angels, I don't know, about 10 times a show, but here we get to talk about it in the context of charity.
Right. So I have not painted that many Blood Angels before, but this was an excellent excuse to get some practice on these. You know, they're obviously a very important chapter, Legion, whatever. And it's something that it was nice to have a little push to, okay, go and practice this, get this skill under your belt. So in this case, I, you know, painting these up for the Nova Open Charity Foundation, Herrick Games and Hobbies sent me a bunch of unpainted Marines. Old Jawa Balls told me how to paint them up. And it is sometimes really nice to have a painting project where you don't have to make any hard decisions. You just have, you have a recipe out there, go and do this. And it takes some of the stress away, not have to make those choices.
Red can be a tricky color, though. I mean, did you do okay with it, you think?
I actually like red. Red is, I think, one of my favorite colors to paint. The way it's pretty translucent, and so highlighting and stuff is very forgiving. You know, going and doing an edge highlight, it kind of almost like blends itself because there's that translucence there, and so it's going to take a couple of layers anyway. And you know, by the time you build up a couple of layers, your mistakes all even out with each other. So I actually like painting red.
That's how I get good looking Blood Angels, is the forgivingness of the thin coats of red. but yeah, I'm right there with you.
I mean, in my case, I was also using the airbrush, and every color is pretty easy with an airbrush. You know, I know some people have that fear of red if they're just staring at a black primed mini or something like that, and then they have their jar of paint and they need to layer on five layers to make it look like an even red. But that's not the case here. With an airbrush, a couple of thin coats, you got your base red, know that primer is sticking through. And then after that, when you're putting on the details, layering up some highlights, doing anything fancy, that translucency really helps in that case. It keeps you from making like really noticeable mistakes when you're doing edge highlighting or something like that. You know, blue covers in a single coat a lot of the time. You put on a little bit of light blue when you're highlighting some ultramarines, you make a mistake, it's going to be very noticeable. But red, you can really build that up slow, and it's nice. So yeah, I have no problems with red. It's one of those things that, you know, for the last 20 years has been on my list of things to do someday, paint a whole bunch of Space Marines. And just being in the hobby for a while, you know, I keep collecting more and more models. Seems every eBay or Craigslist deal, regardless of what I'm buying, there's also like a squad of tactical Marines in there. So, you know, I have a pile of unpainted Space Marines. And throughout my life, it's been like for really 20 years, I've been trying to decide what chapter to paint. And that is such a hard decision. And so in this case, it was just really nice for somebody to say, you need to paint these three squads of Marines. They need to be red. You're going to use Mephiston red and you're going to use blood red. And we want to get some shadows looking kind of black like this. And that takes all the stress away. You know, I've spent years trying to decide between Blood Angels and Imperial Fists and Salamanders. You know, those are the three big ones. And then, of course, like, what if I want to make my own chapter?
Yeah.
I could do a successor chapter, or what about colors that people don't use so often? Or none of that stress here. We're just going to paint some Blood Angels. Here's the codex. Here's the symbols that are supposed to be on the knee pads and the shoulders. Get to it. And with all the decisions made, it was a pretty fun painting project. Just get in there and put paint on the model.
Well, I was happy to see you do it, man. So what got you to working with the Charitable Foundation? And is there any of the particular major causes that they're supporting or that are close to you?
So in my case, I'd actually heard about it for the first time, not to advertise against you here, but I heard about it for the first time on the Independent Characters. And this was a few years ago. And at the time I was like, oh yeah, I want to play in this raffle. I want to, you know, throw my hat in the ring and try to win something here. And so for a couple of years, I've been following the charity, you know, seeing what pops up, seeing who's involved. And over that period of time is, you know, the last couple of years has been when I've been building up this YouTube channel, Goobertown Hobbies. And it got to the point where, okay, you know, in addition to just, you know, contributing the price of my raffle tickets, I could probably contribute some, you know, publicity to this event. And it is a really fun event. You know, it's a charity that involves the possibility of big, big prizes and kind of bringing the gaming community together to do something worthwhile and fun. So that's why I wanted to get involved. You know, the major charities, they're all good things. For me, I don't have any personal ties to any of the big charities here. I think they're all worthwhile.
No, that's pretty cool, man. Yeah, and you're right. I mean, this is, you're talking about the communities. If the artists get to come together, they're donating their time and the models and stuff. And then, you know, we're coming from this side of it, you know, with a few dollars and maybe the dream that we walk away with something. But it's really about the charities and what they're able to accumulate every year. I mean, this is good. And it's cool to see more and more people being a part of this in either of those capacities.
Yeah, and I know this year, you know, because Nova Open had to be canceled, along with everything else this year, I know they were, you know, a little bit worried about not bringing in the same kind of haul that they've done in previous years, but I think they're actually doing all right. So people keep buying tickets in the last few days here. They actually might do pretty well for these charities this year.
I'm hoping so. So they do some really cool things on site with the lounge. And a lot of good times are had there, and we're going to try to replicate that with the live stream, man. We'll see, you know, I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah. You know, this year I was really looking forward to going to conventions, and I definitely had Gen Con and Adepticon on my list this year. You know, I had tickets and everything for those, and those didn't happen. And I was thinking about Nova. I have not been to Nova yet. And this could have been the year, maybe next year.
I hope we all get back to normal. You know, it's one of those things to where that's like, I really enjoy the camaraderie and everything every year. And so, you know, this year it's a little bit different, but you know, I think that's where, you know, stuff like this, us talking or whatever, it's all, we're still building those new relationships, meeting new folks and doing our hobby thing. And that's, you know, so while things are different, there's still a lot of normal that we're doing right now.
Right. You know, you asked if I wanted to be on a podcast and I said, absolutely. I need that human contact. Thanks for talking to me. Good to hear from you. Good to hear a human voice. This is great.
Brett, it has been so nice talking with you. I hope, can we catch up with you again in the future?
Absolutely.
Awesome, man. Have a great rest of your night. And we'll talk soon.
And you have a good one.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Oscar Lars.
Hey, how's it going everyone?
Yo, Oscar, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
So, but I also got you on to talk about your involvement in the Nova Open Charitable Foundation. You have a couple of entries this year that people can purchase raffle tickets for a shot of winning. And oh my goodness, is it worth it if people want to take a shot at these? I mean, you are an absolute amazing painter. And I want to kind of pick your brain about how you did it, you know, what you actually play, you know, do you play? What got you into painting? And then we'll tell people how to find the stuff.
Yeah, sounds great. Yeah. These two miniatures were actually the two that I painted on the YouTube tutorials that I did for free for anybody to use. And I thought it would be a fun little thing to throw them up there for people to win because people have seen these models being painted. So it adds a little something extra to it and just not being models that were painted.
Well, I mean, I dig it. So do you play Age of Sigmar, is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, I play Age of Sigmar and I am getting into Necromunda slowly because it's 2020 and everybody is aware of what's going on.
Man, I am in love of the Goliath gangs. I mean, you have a Twitter feed also and we can. Yeah. Do you mind sharing your Twitter?
Yeah, yeah, it's just Oscar Lars, at Oscar Lars on Instagram, on YouTube. You can search Oscar Lars on Twitter as well to find me there. My website is oscarlars.com. So everything is just Oscar Lars, super simple.
Oh, that is pretty simple. But you, yeah. I saw you painting those Goliath. It was the same time I was painting my Goliath.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yours look absolutely awesome.
Oh, thank you so much.
So how long have you been painting?
I started painting when I was 7 years old. And
I was hoping it was going to be a long time. If you told me like 2 years or 12 years or whatever, I was just going to. I wanted it to be a long time.
I've been painting for a long time. I also have a bachelor's in fine arts, so I also have some experience and history in paintings, which is what I studied over there, and color theory and things like that. So I do have sort of a little bit of a background in art since a young age. And miniature painting was also always something that I enjoyed, and I just kind of never stopped doing it. So I figured, why not make a living out of it and see if that could work? And eventually, it started working. So,
well, the depth of color that you can get, and the richness of things. I mean, when I look at a model, the things that stand out to me are the things that I strive to do better at are things like textures.
Mm-hmm.
And you seem to—I mean, you seem to really have those in everything I've seen of yours.
Yeah, I mean, texture is something that I think is very important, because it's something that can help identify, you know, materials on a model. Because most of the surfaces, unless we think about, for example, what has been sculpted already, need some sort of definition to it. So if you have a stone horn, for example, from the Beastclaw Raider line of Age of Sigmar, then you have all of these different, you know, textures of the fur, right? So you can just dry brush that or paint it or however you want to approach that. It's already there for you. But when you have something like a cloth on a knight, for example, like the Chaos Warriors have a few of those that aren't sculpted. It's just flat and doesn't really have any sculpted definition. Then it allows for you to go in and start adding in your own inspiration to it. So you can do patterns or you can do little fine lines to make it a little bit more interesting. And that will help to separate that from, say, if you paint an armor, because the armor would be a little bit more flat, for example.
So that is, it sounds intimidating. You just described it in a very basic way, but it's still, when I look at a blank surface, and like, for instance, on the back of this Hallowed Knight, Stormcast, mm-hmm. is up for raffle on the NovaOpenFoundation.org website. You've got wood grain on the back of this shield. Can you give any tips on how to make that the journey into getting into that a little bit more accessible to somebody who may not, you know, think they could try?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that the rule number one, I think, of painting is that if you don't try, you will never know and you will never learn how to do something. So the first step is to just dive into it. And if you fail, it's not a problem, really. I can't tell you how many times I've tried something and failed. It's this, the way we learn how to do things, right? Because we try something, it didn't work out well, then we tweak the approach and we try again, and maybe that time it went better. A lot of the times when I paint something, I go through several different versions of a model, of a recipe or something like that, until I land on something that I feel satisfied with. The Goliaths were actually something where I tried a few different red recipes in order to see what worked best. And not only, you know, the colors that I apply to it, but like of what ratio do I leave exposed? You know, how much dark red do I want versus how much mid-tone red do I want? How much light stark orange do I want in visible to the eye? The same goes for example, this recipe. It's as simple, which is relative, right? But it's as simple as just, lines that goes down the shield of, you know, a base coat of dark and then a mid-tone. So in this case, it was Dryad Bark. And this is from the Citadel range, the Dryad Bark. And in Steel Legion Drab, I started doing thicker lines with it. And then the last thing I did was Carrick Stone. And I did more finely thinner lines with a smaller brush, a size 00, and just kind of try to trace over those Steel Legion Drab lines. And sometimes you fail, and sometimes you get them nice and thin, and if you get them a little thicker, you can always go back with the colors that you have in there so the giant bark of the Steel Legion drum, and sort of clean it up a little bit.
There you go. Just work it a few times, and then you got wood grain.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's nice. I mean, I may give it a shot. I mean, the things like leather and wood, if it's not sculpted wood, if I can't dry brush over wood, it just is flat for me. And so we get hearing tips like that and making it sound, you know, I guess attainable is nice.
Yeah. And that's the thing is that at some point, the best thing you can do is to try to, before you go into something complex, and this is what I recommend to the people that for example, took my class last year at Nova Open and how to do non-metallic metal, I try to simplify the technique of non-metallic metal as much as I could without losing the sort of basic fundamental that you need to have to make a illusion that it has a sense of metallic property to it. And you know, you can go crazy and look at, for example, Richard Gray's work. I mean, that non-metallic metal is way more complex than mine is. But it doesn't have to be that complex to sell the point that you're trying to make with.
Is there a point of diminishing returns? The answer is, I guess, depends. But in your experience for miniature painting, does there end up being like for tabletop or better than tabletop? And I'm not trying to, you know, categorize art really, more just, you know, are you kind of alluding to, you know, get it to the way you want it to look? And then that's as far as you have to go.
Let's see if I understand the question. Are you asking me if I'm trying to if there's a way to define what's tabletop and what's better than tabletop and what's sort of masterclass or something like that?
Or how to make yourself happy? Like when to know that you, when to put the model down and say you've done good work?
Yeah, I mean that's definitely one of those good questions that are floating around that I think there is no answer to, and there's several answers to. and my answer is always, you know, you have to know and recognize and be honest with yourself where you are at in your journey. I have to live with, you know, where I'm at in my career and in my painting standard. And sometimes I push it as far as I can go and make something as crazy as I can. And other times I try to, you know, paint something that looks good, but it doesn't have to be complex and groundbreaking in the way that it's constructed with colors and techniques and all that stuff. And because if you always paint to your best ability, there will be where you start with an army in the beginning, and then at the end of the army, the qualities look completely different. And that's something that can be fun to see, right? You know, you look at the progression that you've made over the army that you painted.
Just let you start again. You get to go back to the first squad you painted and touch it up.
Exactly. Because and I've heard a lot of people say that, and then they go back to the first model they painted and need to repaint it and over and over and over again, and that becomes like this vicious cycle that you end up in. That you look back at the work. I mean, I look back at work that I painted 2 years ago and think, oh shit, I need to, you know, make this better, or I should have done that better. But in the end, the decisions that I made then is the reason why I'm here now. So there's nothing to really to regret for me, or that's what I tell myself, at least.
Yep. No, that's awesome. Well, I mean, this is absolutely astounding work. You got two figures up there this year. I know that sometimes you get planned well in advance. Are you thinking about maybe doing some next year too?
I think that, you know, this kind of contribution to not just the community, but to a good cause is very important for me. I think especially now with everything that's going on, it's more important than ever to, you know, give to the community and show that, you know, not everybody's just in it for themselves, but that together we can create something really great together. So I'm definitely contributing every year to this cause for as long as I can, and look forward to every year to contribute more and more interesting pieces.
Okay. Well, Oscar, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Can I reach out to you again in the future?
Absolutely. I would love to be on again.
Great, man. Well, I will put your links in the show notes so people know where to find you, and then also links to your entries into the raffle this year. And absolute great, great points. Every ticket that someone purchases goes to a good cause. And yeah, this is a really worthwhile endeavor.
That's exactly right.
Thanks, man.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to a community spotlight segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this afternoon by Duncan Rhodes.
Hello. How's everybody doing? How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you for joining me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Nice to be here.
Yeah, so I want to bring you on specifically this time to talk about your contribution to the Nova Open Charitable Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Reynald, Vengeance of the Lost. Yeah, one of my Imperial Knights.
This is from your personal collection.
It is. I painted it quite a while ago when I was making a second lance for my House Griffith army. And quite a lot of knights.
Yeah, well, I know it's still, once you do that, once you get it in and it lives on the shelf and it's performed on the tabletop for you, you know, how do you bring yourself to part with it? This is obviously for a good cause. Are these some things that you feel personally strong about?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm very attached to it. Like all the knights I've painted, I guess anyone who's painted one knows they take a bit of time and a bit of investment, especially if you're really going to the heraldry like I did. Reynald's one that I painted because in the IP for House Griffith, they're meant to have lots of knight errant suits of armor, more than the other different variants that they've got. So I kind of thought that my army had more paladins than errants. So I thought, all right, no, I ought to balance that up a little bit. So that's the main reason I started painting him. And I played a few big games with the model. And poor Reynald, he's made a few boo-boos, lost a few duels against Eldar constructs and things.
It could be a difficult road, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's right. But he's always had a lot of character to him. So, yeah, it's a really nice model. And I like putting the character in him of him being a little bit more on the Mechanicus side rather than the Imperial side, hence his banner having a Cog Mechanicum on it and stuff. But when Nova approached me asking, you know, if there's anything I could do for it, at the time, I was working with my friend Roger to set up the Painting Academy, you know, the business that we run now. So I didn't have time to make anything bespoke for them, but I wanted to do something that would have meaning and, you know, that would have, I guess, value in an emotional sense for the auction, for the raffle. So, I kind of thought, you know, what could I contribute? And I figured an Imperial Knight would be something that would be meaningful and also recognizable. So, I hope it's able to raise some funds.
Well, I love this color scheme, and you know, speaking on the raffle side, you know, are these causes that the Nova Open Charitable Foundation are supporting, are they also important to you? Is contributing to this more than just the model itself?
Yeah, well, it's I'm always keen to, you know, to like help out with the cause if I can. This, the one I chose, because we were able to select where, you know, funds would go. And for me, it was for breast cancer research. And it's because my mum had breast cancer. Now, she got through it and everything. But at the time, it was very, very scary. So that's something that's always stayed with me. Like, you know, it's, you know, when you get the kind of feeling like, oh, it'll never happen to me. And yeah. Then suddenly it happens very close to home. And you realize that, you know, life isn't unknown. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So I figured that, you know, if it's going to help raise some funds for that kind of cause, then someone will hopefully come out. Like, we'll get, I don't know if you call it lucky or what, but I hope that would help somebody.
Well, paying it forward,
you know,
right?
Yeah. I hope it can help someone whose family is going through a similar situation. So, you know, out of all the choices, I thought, you know, yeah, I'll do that. That's something I want to support. Something I believe in, something I've experienced. So hopefully Reynald can heroically raise some funds for it.
Well, I mean, it looks up stellar. I mean, this is a really smooth paint job with the heraldry. I mean, crisp lines and stuff. I mean, what we would expect from you, but you've put it all, you know, and like the knights seem to be uniquely, I guess, modeled to showcase that kind of stuff. And you've got a lot of different examples of talent and, I guess, process on this model.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. It's right from day one. I remember, like, way back when I was working in the hobby team, they called it at the time, when we had our first briefing meeting with the knights, and they were showing us the image, because the models hadn't been like made, like done in resin yet. This was still like early days when they were making them, and we were showing some examples of how they thought the heraldry was going to play out. And it's like, oh man, this is my thing.
Well, you do, where you just wring in your hands and,
oh yeah, they're like, look at me dead in the eye and say they're not Bretonians in space. And I'm like, uh-huh of course they're not, but that one's going to have a fleur-de-lis on it.
they are really showcase models, and you have not disappointed with this one.
Well, they're fantastic. They're one of the best things in 40K, I think. I know in game-wise, they're a very... sometimes can be an unbalancing aspect. I mean, more modern 40K certainly handles them better than they were at the time when they first came out. But their IP is so rich and so detailed. Right from the very start, they fit perfectly into the universe. Sometimes with a new faction, it'd be a bit of a challenge, you know, to make it feel like it belongs there. But the Knights, day one, straight in there. So it's always been loads of fun painting them. And I mean, an army of them is 4 at most. And I've done a lot more than that.
I was going to ask, how many knights do you personally own right now?
11. Well, 10 now, I suppose. and I've got the parts to make a whole number more. I've got enough bits to make every variant of them. I've not really needed to just recently.
Well,
I think
you have 11, epic, so I mean, come on, you're gonna.
Well, Epic Titanicus. You know, I keep thinking of Epic with all the knights running around. That's like, for me, that's the level that you play this game at, right?
Yeah.
With that, being able to collect armies of knights in Titanicus, that's the. I'm sorry, it's scratching that itch for me because now I can do all these variants and full lances and formations. But yeah, with it in 40K, it totally absorbs me into, you know, into the flavour of that army. So Reynald's the one that I put forward for it. And we've got Reynald himself dismounted from the suit of armour. So there's a figure of him walking along. This is based on the model that comes with the Knight Preceptor. If you build him as Canis Rex, pilot separate, but, you know, he's converted to holding a sword like he's about to walk into melee. And I thought it'd be fun to include 2 of his men-at-arms alongside him as well. And these are conversions that I did that are very simple. They're Genius Healer Cultists with a few, like, alterations with some Skitarii.
Yeah, aren't those kits fabulous, though, just to for... I mean, they're so, I guess, multifunctional.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're amazing. They're a converter's dream, those kits, especially with the Skitarii. And, you know, the sculptors have some crossover there, so they're designed to kind of be mixed and matched. So it's a very easy conversion to do. And if anyone does want to, you know, create household troops like that, you're basically using Skitarii Vanguard heads on them. And in the pack of Skitarii troops, you get so many heads that you can still build the whole unit of Rangers. You'll have all the Vanguard heads left over, so it's then perfect to put into your Genestealer Cultists.
You're dead on with those extra heads. I've used them too. I made this whole, like, Traitor Guard really run-down thing, and like, oh, they need to be having, like, helmets, mm-hmm. you know, or something that I can further weather. I'm like, oh, I have a whole 10 extra set of heads on this Skitarii set.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I've even seen them used in Age of Sigmar's, like, you know, steampunky kind of free guild.
Oh, wow, like...
That's so useful.
Free People's Null, I don't know, firm, mm-hmm. what was the old, the Cannoneers or something?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, if you want to have kind of like more high-tech sort of Caradron Overlord-looking gear, as if the humans have been trading with the Caradron or something, then they're perfect.
Man, that sounds awesome. No, it really does. It, you know, and God, I know we kind of went down a little bit of a tangent on these figures, but yeah, I mean, I mentioned all the techniques and stuff on this, including kit bashing. Man, that's so cool. I know that I would love to personally own a figure done by you in my collection, and this is a really cool way to get a shot at it and support a good cause at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope whoever does win it is able to perform many heroics and daring charges, you know, charging everything, obviously. I hope that they're able to use Reynald's dismounted and his men-at-arms as part of a kill team or something like that, you know, or perhaps in scenario play, things like that. Whoever wins it, I just hope they really enjoy it, and I hope it's able to really help Nova out, because it's a good cause and, you know, wants to do well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Duncan, thanks a lot for taking the time with me. And we're going to be doing a live stream coming up on September 12th. So maybe we can check in with you in some capacity then as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, it'd be good fun to do so, yeah.
All right, man. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
FTN is brought to you by Bell of Lost Souls. Check out www.bols.org for the best daily hobby articles on the web.
And we are back. It's so great to hear from those folks who are enthusiastic about their art and the causes for the charity. I know I'm excited.
Yeah, amazing initiatives. Awesome people out there. Like, our community is one of a kind, and people just continue to show their caliber and their generosity at every turn.
Yeah, and hopefully y'all can find time. I know it's on a Saturday. You know, it's going to be getting into the afternoon, for especially on the East Coast or in Europe. Who knows? But, you know, tune in worldwide. They will, if we didn't mention it before, the foundation will ship worldwide, so you can get tickets from anywhere. There is a minimum of 10 USD dollars purchased, so sometimes you have to get 2 tickets, you know, to get that $10 minimum of $10. That's just the way it works with the, so you might have to get 2 tickets for things. You double your chances on one thing, or diversify, maybe come home with 2 things.
Nice.
But they will ship anywhere in the world, which is Amazing. Come hang out with us. And if even if look, and I mentioned this on the last one, if you can't contribute, not in a position to contribute, that's cool too. Hang out with us. Throw us a like or share it out. Tell your friends to come hang out with us. We're gonna have some pre-recorded segments from some stellar folks. We're gonna have some special guests, and we're gonna be hanging out there doing our thing. So it's gonna be great.
Yeah, dude, I actually can't wait. I'm really excited about this.
Yep. So Necrons. I know we started talking about Necrons. We were trying to get Red revved up about Necrons, and then
you got me revved up about something tanks. Else. But I'm still revved up about Necrons. Don't get me wrong.
You think we're going to get reanimation protocols, an alteration of that, and we'll hear about it on this stream or the preview?
I tell you what. So I'm in a one hardcore Necron chat and a couple other great ones that I can't tell you how bad we've been pining for reanimation protocols and what that change is going to be, because it's just such a crucial deal. I know I've talked about it before, so I don't want to belabor the point, but reanimation protocols is, I mean, that's Tau get Overwatch for free. Space Marines get 5 traits. Chaos Space Marines get 1 to 2 traits. Necrons have dynasty traits and reanimation protocols. And so it's just such a crucial part of the army in certain regards. And you can tell, I mean, you could see it in 8th edition, just how much it was calculated into the cost of points for all the for a warrior, right? I mean, exactly. And
funny story. I posted the, you know, our last show, you know, top 9 Space Marine killers, hot or not thing. And one of the comments we got was that the Necron Warriors with the new gun is his preferred Space Marine killer.
I can imagine why, honestly. And I think with the new, maybe they'll talk about dynasty traits. Maybe. I'm kind of excited to see what they come up with. I tell you what, the Reapers, right? The Flayers were what they had before. The Reapers are the new one. I have 3 Necron sets that I'm looking over at in a box near my desk. And all of those warriors I'm going to build with Reapers, because I think that there's a lot of potential to them. I think that they should not be discarded. I think that the dynasty traits are really going to help them out in certain ways, one way or the other.
Neg 1 or whatever it is, AP, when you stack it up with some of the dynasty traits, will probably be good.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that the strength 5, I understand it's shorter range and all, but I think that the warriors and their positions, I mean, you build up warriors, whether they're 10-man squads or 20-man squads, depending on what you're bringing. I'm interested to see what happens with Ghost Arcs, which we discussed previously, in regards to reanimation protocols. Because right now, as it stands, those, the canoptic reanimators that come with the Indominus kit, plus warriors, plus a cryptech, plus a Ghost Arc, so that's +2 to their reanimation roll. So technically they're reanimating on 3s. Warriors are naturally rerolling 1s. And then the Ghost Arc allows them to reanimate twice right now. I mean, that's, if you don't completely kill a 20-man Necron warrior squad, I mean, it's doing that twice.
Is it 2/3 coming back?
Yeah. I mean, again, rerolling 1s, like you've got a lot coming back, and that range, like, okay, these are all objective secured. You've got to kick them off the objective and they're going to be there they're going to keep coming back. And with scoring in the command phase, like, you can't just put a couple, you know, even custodes or whatnot. Like, you've got to make sure you kill all those guys or else they're going to deny you that objective come your command phase.
I think you've talked on a lot of really good points. One that I like is the fact that we almost know how much the price that GW has put on reanimation. It's like a third of a Necron Warrior's cost was the cost of the reanimation protocol.
Right.
So you can draw some parallels from there, but you know what GW's priced it as, how valuable they want it to be in their eyes. They wanted to add a third efficiency or a third reliability. So when you talk about a third of the guys coming back per reanimation, that's about on right for what their cost is. But the problem is, you just didn't have any efficient way of making it happen, because people would just be like, oh, well, I need to kill What are you saying? If I kill all these guys, either you have to pay 2 CP to not have the last guy's auto run, or I just charge him and I wipe out the last few. But when you say that if you just leave one guy, not only do I get 1/3 back, but I get like possibly 2/3, 3/4 back, that's really changing the dynamics and what they've costed it as. While I still think it holds true to the fluff and kind of what you want them to be. So if you were to get, say, if I'd have reanimation protocols and I bought a cryptech and I bought these other two support units,
in them. So what you exactly, but right. A big chunk of your points are not in some of the quote unquote flashier things they're in. Mm. You've invested in making this block, this brick sit here.
Yeah.
Yes.
So there used to be a Lich Guard Death Star you could make in 6th and 7th edition. I used to call it a cinder block because it was bigger and tougher than a brick and I just needed a name for it. But I would really like that to be a term that you can say about Necrons again. It was like, oh, well, what style is he playing? Oh, he's playing the cinder block. It's just where it's just like 60 Necron warriors that just you have to put so much work into kill. That would be sick.
And then if you don't, that's the thing. When you don't, you leave 5 of them or whatever and your heart just sinks.
Exactly.
Yeah, when you get stuff like that going, when you get those big numbers of wounds on the board, especially reliable wounds, what you want to do is just want to start trying to expose your opponent to variance, the peaks and troughs in the natural rolls that we have on a D6 dice, you know? And so when you do commit to trying to kill 20 warriors, but all of a sudden the warriors are in obscuring terrain and they're -1 to hit, you expose your opponent to variance. And then in their calculation, when they say, okay, I just need this amount of things to shoot that to get them down, and when you mess with that, playing that style, I think, is like right up Necron's alley. Playing with people's expectations and then defying them. I think that's exciting.
It's something. I mean, but that's, I think that once we get that, if that rule changes, that will instantly start affecting what people are mentally planning their army to be.
I agree. I mean, there's a lot to it, right? And how it changes in consideration of, say, you know, so it's a thing with, obviously, if the way to beat reanimation protocols is to just kill every model, it obviously becomes a difficulty with take like destroyers, right? Take the new Scorpec destroyers that can only be a squad of 3. It feels like currently as it stands that reanimation protocols is taking a hit because there's only, I mean, so there's 4 models technically if you count the plasma site. But that's still, and that's actually another great reason why you should take the plasma site, because it's another model specifically. And so when it comes to reanimation protocols, it's kind of difficult to justify with these smaller units. It just doesn't do as well. Like you definitely, you know, it's less dice that you're rolling. And so
that's kind of okay though. I mean, they're more of your elite. I mean, they do more damage per model. I mean, in a vacuum. Talk about in a vacuum.
True. In a vacuum.
If it works for them, then you feel like you as the player of the Necrons have won something. Like when you get that file up or whatever, or they don't kill that unit to the man, then you're like, oh man, I'm now really winning.
Well, and so that's where, so I was running multiple destroyer units beforehand where they could be up to units of 6. And so with a cryptech nearby on 4s, they were coming back. And of course, when they come back, it's not like in you know, the apothecary or whatever, they don't come back with X amount of wounds. They come back at full wounds. And so when a destroyer comes back with 3 wounds, I mean, that's, you're right. Like that's those elite, more elite units and whatnot. And then to have that many models maybe come back with that many wounds is quite a bit. And so I'm interested to see the changes because I do think that there's going to be some adjustments. And even if it goes to it being by wound, I mean, that's, again, more dice I think is better. And I think we see that in almost all instances.
But let's just say that gets like remarkably better or more reliable to get things back without having to stack all that kind of stuff up. That goes back to what we're talking about. Like I may then want the Repulsor Executioner over the Gladiator because of the volume of fire that it can put out. Now, less quality fire, but I might be able to kill more warriors to get those. I mean, you could fire, I don't know, what's a really great 3-shot weapon or whatever from Plasma Executioner or whatever.
Sure.
Yeah, at a unit of warriors, but sometimes you're just going to really wish you had the Punisher.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I think if it's more reliable that they get back, and like if they can come back more often, then I'm probably going to want to make sure they're dead more often, and so fire more, you know, random fake cubes out in the air at them.
Well, you just start looking for things that are more reliable rather than things that have these big payouts. Like you look for, I mean, obviously blast weapons become a premium, but you look for things that have got the perfect profile for killing what you're looking for. So like this is weird. And not a lot of people might agree with me here, but for the costs, look at like a Lehman Russ Eradicator. Strength 6, -3, D3 damage with the blast keyword, which ignores cover. So the best defensive buff that those Necrons can get right now, apart from the 5+ invuln, is having them in cover. So being able to, now I can't remember the wording on the Eradicator actually, maybe I've spoken a little bit out of turn there, because I'm not sure if it ignores the -1 as well. It might only ignore the bonus to your armor save. But even then, -3 and ignoring the armor save means they don't get a save at all. So unless you've got a Crypt Tech, they don't get any save against that stuff, which you couldn't say the same for, say, a Battle Cannon, which is more expensive, admittedly, but you get the better range and you get the better strength. But denying a save in entirety just feels better to me in some cases. Mm-hmm. Now, I doubt anybody has heard that me say anybody say Lehman Russ Eradicator in quite a long time. So, that is a real fringe case. It might not even work out that way.
Stats when you said it, I wanted to know. Like, oh my goodness, what am I supposed to say right now?
Well, I couldn't even remember what the wording was on this ignore cover rule. It used to be my go-to in Sem's edition because everybody was toe in cover, getting like obscure, so shrouded and stealthy and shrouded and stuff. And so I'd always take that one over the main battle cannon. But yeah, not so much the case anymore. But like things like that, fringe cases, if these things start becoming dominant in the meta, you start looking for the things that are the perfect profiles to remove them. Because you know they're going to be packing 20 mans because you're just getting the best mileage possible out of all your buffs if you're taking the bigger squads, more wounds, et cetera, et cetera. So then you can really start trying to polarize not what they're necessarily bringing, but what you're bringing to counter them. And of course, like you're never going to regret having a big punchy blast weapon. It's never going to be that bad an idea. And I'm not necessarily saying that the Lehman Russ Eradicator is the one-stop shop for your Necron killing needs, but it's just a fringe case I thought it'd be nice to bring up.
Hey, anytime we can shine a light on a rarely used model, why not, right?
Oh, dude, I've got 4 of those turrets. I've got literally 4 of them. I'm like, who will let me proxy these as demolishers? Like, do I need to hit up the TO? Nah, I'm thinking about cutting.
I think Necrons are they're going to come into their own here. Way more options than they've ever had.
Oh, yeah. So not just counting Dynasty, and of course, the reanimation protocols is exciting. And we kind of talked about it before, but even the monolith, right? I mean, when you show me a monolith that has 4 death rays attached to it, the death ray being and that was in one of the previews, but the previously, I think that was the same time as the Gladiator. The death ray is currently on the Doom Scythe, and it is a D3. Strength 10, AP -4, D6. But if leaks are to be followed, and if there's any salt to this rumor, take it now. But to say that it's going to be D3 shots or something like that, or even 3 shots, and that it's going to have much like the repulsor executioner, and it has 3 damage plus D3 damage on top.
Yeah,
I mean, to have 4 of those with this monolith, sure, I expect the price to be up there, but at the same time, that's going to be pretty monumental.
But would it hurt your feelings though if 2 monoliths and 60 warriors was a good army again? I mean, that's a throwback.
Awesome. That wouldn't hurt my feelings.
I'd love that. I think that'd be sick.
Yeah, that'd be great.
But we've already got a precedent for G-Dub wanting to narrow the curve and make things a little bit more reliable. If you just look at the perceived melter changes that we've seen, melter going to 2 plus D6 damage within the melter ranges rather than being the 2D6 take the highest.
I love it.
Yeah, maybe they're flattening out some of the curves, some of the peaks and troughs, like I was saying before.
Well, just trying to make the weapon, it just does it. Like there's like with a battle cannon, this is like the classic example of it doesn't work out the way you want it to work out or you think it works out. It's like, oh, I've got D6 shots. Okay. I roll a 6. Oh, crap. I only hit twice, but I still fired the same big cannon.
Yeah.
Like it just doesn't feel the same. So with smooth, I mean, we have but long since, I guess, been an advocate. Some of it wishful thinking, some of it sour grapes, some of it just one wishing and hoping or whatever, right? But saying like a D3 plus 3 is way better than D6. I mean,
even 2D3. Just give us 2D3 instead of D6.
Yeah, 2D3 better than a D6. Yeah, that's probably a better way of phrasing it. 4 weapons that you feel that way about it. Like a battle cannon, 2D3 is better than 1D6. Like a basilisk having 2D6 pick the highest. I think that's cool. I mean, it feels fine.
Mm.
Because
yeah, I feel like that's fine.
Indirect fire. It's
yeah.
You're. I mean, I know we just talked about you could dial it into the, you know, to the meter or whatever. But me, as somebody who knows none of that, just feeling like I'm firing my tank 120 inches. Yeah. I feel like it's going to be a little bit of guesswork sometimes.
Yeah, it feels of all the things, that one feels pretty reasonable, doesn't it?
Yeah, but so yeah, talking about what is it? Crafting the variants, curating the variants.
Yeah, or if it's in COVID terms, it's leveling out the curve. It really is leveling out the curve. So maybe like, so you saw it with, you saw, I suppose the worst example of what happens when you level out the curve too much is Centurions. Where you have your Centurion unit would come down and pick your poison. Like you pick your melee ones or your Devastator ones. It doesn't really matter. Both these are examples of what happens when you level it out too much, because they both become units that can do everything. They can kill everything. But I suppose knocking off the top band of the peaks and bringing up the bottom, I think is a great idea. And I'll speak this from a Necron point of view, having to take three Doomsday Arcs in every list to have the option to play the game when you get the short table deployments, admittedly on the old boards, which were considerably bigger, it felt bad. It felt like you were forced into this, was it 500, 600 point investment pre-game before you even get the choice of what kind of style list you want to take, simply because you want to contend. That feels bad. And then when you get to the table, the thing has D6 shots and D6 damage. So you get six shots, and then you get one wound at the end, or you get one shot and then six wounds at the end. You know, the variance on that is monumental. Bringing those downs and bringing the bottom up and the top down, I feel like it makes everyone happier. There's less feel bad moments in the interactions where you could have three Doomsday Arcs shooting at a knight, and between them, they get three shots because you rolled ones on all of them with a CP reroll as well. And then you're just like, I'm going home. Take up your models and you leave the event. It's just like, this is not fair. It's
not fair. There you go. Well, I think we turned part of our predictions into hopes and dreams and wishful thinking. But this is, this is going to be fun.
Yeah, no, I'd say I feel pretty confident about the monoliths to certain degrees with what they're going to bring. And I do think that you're going to see something of the older lists of your, you know, 5th edition, 4th edition, those kinds of things. I do think that there's going to be a lot more weight to that possibility.
Man, if I can make a whole dreams. If I can make a whole army out of Star Gods and Scorpeth Destroyers, I'm kind of tempted.
It's saucy. But I'm just of the opinion that no model that looks as cool as that monolith is going to be horrible. That's at least that's my hope. When was the last time they brought out a really good looking model that was bad?
Oh, you know,
I can tell you some bad looking models that were bad. never mind.
Well, guys, this has been a fun show. We're getting ready again to do the live stream. Please come check us out. Please like, share, and subscribe. If you haven't already, leave a comment. Really enjoy the discussions that's coming around. Please also leave us a 5-star review wherever you listen to us. It really helps boost the signal of the show. Yeah, it means a lot. Thank you for listening. Red, Adam, thanks a lot for the really awesome discussion this week.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
I want my super tank, Red. I want it.
It's coming.
Better. Art imitating art, imitating life. There we go.
We'll see y'all this weekend.
Handle the truth.